Good morning, Gretchen Gondek live in Studio A, and we're hearing strains of The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky, which is going to be performed Saturday night at the Orpheum Theater with the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra. And I'm very delighted to welcome Ryan Haskins, music director and conductor of the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra, to the microphone. Good morning, maestro.
Good morning. Great to be here.
And we have Clint Needham, who is going to be unveiling his music for flute on Saturday night. Welcome, Clint.
Great to be here.
Great to have you here. We're going to digress and do this a little bit differently. I thought we would want to spend more time talking with Clint.
Oh, so, fine. I see how it is. So people get used to you, and soon you're out with the next day's trash. I get it.
Let's start with a little conversation about The Rite of Spring. How would you characterize this? Composed in 1913, erratic rhythms, people obviously were not accustomed to hearing this kind of music, and then throw in a very sort of pagan ballet. Walk us through that opening night premiere performance.
Yeah, so, I mean, bombshell is probably the easiest way to describe this work in every sense. You know, in 1913, the patrons of the ballet, even the Ballet Russe at that time, were used to fairly traditional ballet. We're used, you know, think of Nutcracker, beautiful costumes, elegant dancing, beautiful lifts that sort of float in the air. And that was what they were ready for this night. And Diaghilev, who was sort of the premier of Ballet Russe, sort of always had a thing for being on the edge. And he knew, once he heard Stravinsky's music for the first work called Fireworks, he sort of fell in love immediately with Stravinsky's music. And of course, we have the three great ballets. The first was The Firebird, then Petrushka, and then finally The Rite of Spring. And so he knew that the music itself, and then the choreography, of course, directed by the great Nijinsky, would have the crowd on edge a bit. But he went further. He actually stacked the audience in a very deliberate way. So he knew he would have his core group of patrons who were, you know, dressed to the nines and there more to be seen than to actually experience what was happening. And then, of course, in Paris, around that time, you have this battle between the elite and the bohemians. And so he very specifically invited the bohemians, and he literally sat them behind all of these elite people because he knew what kind of reaction would come about. And then he tossed in his own friends sort of within the audience. So I don't think there was an ultimate plan that, okay, at 3 minutes into this piece, I'd like you to stand up and slap this person across the face, which apparently happened. I have no idea. There's a sword fight apparently in the back. I don't know. But you have all these people, you know, the elite reacting to, as you say, these jarring rhythms and harmonies and awkward moments and moments where you just sort of want to, for that audience at that time, who we didn't have jet airplanes and things like this, probably cover your ears because they weren't exposed to sounds like that. Then you toss in the choreography, which the curtain goes up and you have these knock-kneed, you know, circle of young girls with long hair and very angular choreography and very, you know, disjuncted and not pretty sort of choreography. It was sort of set up for this incredible shock. And there were boos, there were hisses, people started talking, but that was part of the energy in the room. And as crazy as it was, and as successful as Stravinsky had been up already to that point, you know, his celebrity sort of was birthed overnight just from this opening night, as crazy as it was. And then all the performances after, there weren't any other, you know, riots or anything like that, but the world just at that point couldn't live without Stravinsky.
Well, I think it's interesting that prior to The Rite of Spring, it was the performance of Les Sylphides, which you couldn't put two more different pieces of music together. So is it an urban myth about the riot and the conductor and the people trying to escape?
No, I mean, I don't think, I mean, there. I think there's probably some embellishments, but you have some pretty reputable, the conductor who debuted, Pierre Monteux, who actually, in a teacher way, I'm removed just from a couple levels, because my teacher studied with him, my first teacher, was not one to elaborate, and he even recalled some, you know, experiences. Of course, he was focused on the music because you don't really have time to not be in this work. But he was actually the saving grace to this performance because if he actually sort of checked out to take on what was happening behind him, I mean, the piece would have fallen apart, as challenging and as wild as it was. So I truly believe, and there's a police report, apparently. The next day there were 27 people who had minor injuries. That's in the book still. So there you go.
And there were some interesting newspaper articles that I came across as well when I was doing some research on this. Would you say this not only revolutionized music, but this is really the piece of music that changed the course of music as we know it to be?
Yeah, it was certainly a turning point. You know, we talk about, and we'll, I'm sure, talk about this with Clint, but we talk about the evolution of music. This, of course, was a major, major turn of events. But it didn't stop there. This is sort of the kicking off point of what we could experience as a world of eager listeners to experience in a concert hall. And it didn't really stop with orchestras either. I mean, I think it rapidly spread. But just chord structures, I mean, you think of the major players in changing of music, and you think of Haydn, or you think of Beethoven, certainly, or you think of Wagner, or you think of Mahler, or you think of all of these incredible lists of composers who did something that no one did at that point, and the world had never experienced it before. And certainly the sort of polyphony, rhythmic polyphony that was going on within this score. And the mixed meter, which quite honestly, when Stravinsky first sat down to write, he couldn't, because he didn't know how to write it, how to actually take what was in his head and put it on paper. And we see that from a lot of his sketches from this work. And it's so we sort of go there, and then, you know, we find ourselves in some weird sort of strange times, like into the 1960s and 70s, where everyone sort of was like, what the heck is going on in music now, where you just, you know, have some one person sitting on a stage scraping a metal sheet and then they bow and that's it, or they set at a piano for some minutes and don't play, and that's the piece. Or you have one of my favorite references is Stockhausen, who wrote a quartet for helicopters. And each member of the quartet was in a separate helicopter, and they broadcasted the music that they were playing through the headset of, you know, that you wear when you're in a helicopter. And they also have these sort of, there's articulation, there's sounds, they make sounds from their mouth too. So they're going, wah! And it, I'm sure that sounded fantastic over the radio. But anyway, but you have, I mean, when the heck will you perform this? I mean, and that's the point. It sort of goes to the extreme of all these moments of time. And at that time, we have to remind ourselves and take ourselves back to 1913, especially an experience like Saturday Night, where it's so raw and fresh and obscure, but beautifully obscure. That's the strength in a live performance of The Rite of Spring.
And 1913, of course, lines up with the Russian Revolution and the eve of
so much going on.
World War One. I mean, I think that's interesting, too.
Yeah.
So the performance in Sioux City, I think the last time I heard Rite of Spring was with Tom Lewis many years ago. Mm-hmm. in Epley Auditorium. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a major event. You've had to pull in a few extra orchestra players, too.
A few. Yeah, we're at over 90 members on stage. Of course, the score calls for some unique instruments, some extended instruments like the alto flute. You know, you don't every day see two bass clarinets on stage. Of course, the Wagner tubas and the horns, bass trumpet. These instruments you don't see. We have a double set of timpani. So yeah, we've got a few people on stage for sure.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the background of the ballet and the storyline?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, it's sort of rooted in this. Stravinsky was exposed to this sort of pagan idea when he was finishing, sort of in the middle of Petrushka, and was exposed to this sort of pagan storyline. And so it's divided into two parts. First, essentially, in the day, and the second part in the night. So the first is the adoration of Earth, the celebration of Earth, and the second portion is the sacrifice. And so the opening tune that's so famous and so terribly difficult for the bassoon is sort of this bone flute, a solo that sort of awakens the world and nature. And as it develops, you hear the sort of squawking and scratching and gnarling of animals, beasts, the trees, the earth sort of waking up into this sort of moment of chaos or anarchy. And that, and then it just sort of returns back to this bassoon solo, and then we go on, and we feel these ritual dances, the very famous first dance, jump, 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 this dance that happens, sort of people tapping out the rhythms of nature. So a lot of the way I design my interpretation is, of course, off of the ballet, because I don't think you can not avoid it. So they go through, essentially, you know, they select the young adolescent, the young girl, to be selected to be sacrificed to celebrate the earth and to celebrate spring. And it goes through a whole thing with the elders and ceremony and a game of tag back and forth with groups of people, and then finally ends with the famous, very famous sacrificial dance, which she dances in, surrounded by all the elders, until she dances herself to death. And we were just talking about that last chord of the entire work in the bass, low strings, if you look at the notes, actually spells out the word dead, D-E-A-D. So
fascinating.
Yeah, there's more to be shared tomorrow night, so you have to come for the rest of the story.
So the second half is 20th century music. The mm-hmm. first half will be dedicated to music of the 21st century.
Yeah.
And we're going to hear a composition by Clint Needham.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Clint. This is true.
Hi.
Yes. So tell us about, is it about a 10-minute piece of music?
Yes. It's a 10-minute piece called Digital Reality. When Ryan and I were talking about the potential for commission, he's like, well, you know, this will be on the same program as The Rite of Spring. And my my initial thought was like, oh, boy, anything but that, right? I can't think of, we were talking about how revolutionary The Rite of Spring was. I can't think of a more revolutionary piece of music. There are certainly revolutionary figures in music history. But that really set the tone for what modern contemporary music was going to be, and it still is the standard, right? So I always ask my freshmen, like, you know, is The Rite of Spring a contemporary piece of music? And they always say yes. I was like, it was written over 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. That would be like Stravinsky saying Beethoven was a contemporary, you know, Beethoven 9 was a contemporary piece of music, and I don't think he would say that. Mm-hmm. But It's such an iconic piece, and I started thinking about how could I bring any connections to this work. And for me, the beauty of the piece is about sort of the human experience of a time, pagan ritual, and this idea of sort of rituals and tribalism. And it hit me one day when I was in the living room with my family, and we were all on a device, iPhones, iPads, video game system, whatever. And these are our rituals now. We're in the same room. We're doing stuff together. We're not dancing rituals together, but we're sort of engaging in this digital world together, but separate. and I started drawing parallels there. And I use a few little quotes from the Rite of Spring throughout the piece just to kind of tie in just a little bit. They're so subtle that I don't know if anyone will pick them up, but they meant something to me creating the work, which is important. The whole piece is about this sort of absurd idea of the pace at which we scroll through things. We get a text, we check our email, we respond to a text, we're annoyed someone doesn't respond fast enough. We get on Facebook or social media, like this, like that, discover someone from our past passed away, someone's had a child. You know, all of these like micro emotions we go through in about 5 minutes. And it's so amazing to me that we have any ability to process it all. And then the piece kind of goes more deeply into sort of a human experience where we reflect on these things. And then at the end, sort of like the worlds kind of iron themselves out and cohabitate together. So that's in a nutshell the piece.
And you have some history with our conductor, I understand.
I do, yeah. So we've been friends for a long time. We went to undergrad together. We sort of, I think, became pretty close through a mutual friend who is now my wife, Hillary, and they were friends. They played chamber music together, and our friendship has grown over the past two decades almost now.
And Clint was with us. We were trying to figure it out. Is it 9 years?
I think 9 years ago.
Yeah. 9 years ago, and he commissioned a work called Inside Out.
Inside and Out.
Inside and Out, which was sort of based off of that art piece by Chihuly in the Jocelyn in Omaha, which was a great, and we paired that with a small piece called Mahler 1. Mm. so challenge to you, I guess. But and so that year, the following season is when we first started then the Composer of the Year program. And Clint plays an important part, a crucial part into that development, which we're now in our eighth year of that, right?
That's
so
amazing,
that would make
yeah.
sense. Clint teaches composition at the Baldwin Wallace University, at the conservatory there. And so I think for us, both of us, it's really fascinating to see 30, 40, 50, 60 sometimes submissions from across the country from these composers who all are under the age of 35, American composers. It's my opportunity to sort of check in to see, okay, that's what this studio is doing now. And it's funny, and I'm sure you have the same experience, Clint, that, you know, you start to identify what studios they're from before you even look at where they're from, just because of it has this sort of effect from their teachers.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating. And we're so proud of that Composer of the Year competition. We've been able to do some amazing, amazing things and bring in some stellar young people who are, no coincidence. I mean, they're all at the top of the game right now, leading the way of the next generation of writing music, not just for orchestra, but just writing music in general. So it's really thrilling, energizing to be a part of that. And I could not do any of that without Clint. So his tenure here, his residency here just for a few days this week, he's doing a concert. The Northwestern Wind Ensemble mm-hmm. is doing a concert tonight with some of his music on it. He was at South Sioux High School the other day. So, you know, it's really great to have someone come here and understand the importance of the outreach and to celebrate, you know, people who get it and who write amazing things. So it was an easy to consider commissioning Clint was very easy. It's always wonderful to work with him. So we're truly honored to have him here.
Well, again, and I say this a lot, but it's very true that the symphony we have in our community is quite remarkable. And much like our public radio station, I mean, the things that that you're doing in community outreach, but also bringing in young composers like Clint Needham, and it's such a great opportunity for audiences to hear, well, in the case of this concert, you know, contemporary music mm-hmm. and music that's just been composed, which to me is so exciting.
Yeah, for me to be included on a work with, you know, really two of my compositional heroes, Kaija Saariaho the flute concerto, mm-hmm. and then Stravinsky is amazing. And I just have to talk a little bit and brag on his really thoughtful programming, which you don't see, especially among regional orchestras, but also, you know, the Cleveland orchestras and New York Phils, they aren't doing, you know, they aren't doing as good a job as Maestro Ryan Haskins is doing in thoughtful programming. And I think it's wonderful. I mean, I just think about the spectrum he is showing the community here, brand new piece of music, this really remarkable score of Danny Elfman, and then, you know, all the things that are going on this year. It's really amazing to show how music is working and living in the lives of everyone who's participating in the art of listening. So I think he's doing a really remarkable job here.
And we want to mention Brian Allred, mm-hmm. who is an amazing musician.
Desange, the concerto written by Sarriaho, is a very special work. Sarriaho herself, the voice that she has, is very unique and special. And it's funny, setting that score next to something like The Rite of Spring, you couldn't find two sort of opposite worlds, because Rite of Spring has to be so specific, and in fact, Stravinsky demands it. But Sarriaho, there's sort of this element of being undefined and sort of ethereal in every sense of that word. and so to shift from those two worlds, you know, this work is about a bird and its sort of journey. So, you know, first it's flying over the orchestra, and what you hear from the orchestra is sort of the play back and forth with the bird. And then eventually, you know, she goes into this old ancient legend about how a bird went to a village and taught the village people how to dance. So this movement's all about dancing. So you hear Brian in his bird-like technique sort of influencing this sort of dance, this really energetic dance within the orchestra. And the extended techniques that are used in the flute are just incredible. I'll tell you, you've not heard a flute. I keep saying this, but I'm serious. You have not heard a flute do any of this before, because there are multiphonics. There's speaking into the instruments. There's shouting. There's just air being blown through the flute and no notes coming out. And people may then ask the question, well, how's that music? Well, gosh, I mean, it music and art, right, is to express what life is about, and this is the ultimate definition of there are no boundaries at all. And someone like Sarriaho has been able to explore this world in ways that we just have not heard. So this is sort of one of the many threads that connects all of these pieces on the program, and that is, you know, Stravinsky provided just that in 1913. The world had never experienced it. Sarriaho brings something that the world has never experienced. And with the commission with Clint, we've not heard it before. So this is, again, one of the many threads that is so integral to this program. It's really going to be an exciting night, and we're thrilled to present it.
I know that you spend a great deal of time planning your programming, Ryan, and you are always thinking, you know, 2 or 3 years in advance. How does the Rite of Spring kind of fit into your resume of conducting? Have you done this before?
Yeah, I have. Not many times, because the opportunity doesn't come very often. You know, that I was just telling the orchestra the other day, this score is infamous for its mistakes. And in the early scores, we were looking at almost 3,000 mistakes in this 38-minute work, 39-minute work. And so Stravinsky himself had several revisions. And then you have also the people behind the scenes who have sort of adjusted things over the years that either were copied wrong in the latest edition of Stravinsky and left out from the original. So you have, I used to, when I would do this work or study it, I would go around literally with four different scores. And now we're performing from an edition that is the cleanest that I've ever seen. It was produced in the early 2000s. Headed by the ex music librarian of the Philadelphia Orchestra, Clinton Neuwig, and the team of very hard workers behind the scene who have gone through and corrected all of these incredible mistakes. So it's daunting on that, but this is the first performance that I've had with such a clean, well laid out score before. And we're actually one of the first prints of this. It was released, but they weren't printing it. And they just started releasing that in May. And we were one of two orchestras, I think, in that first print. So it's kind of cool.
Who knew?
Who knew? Now you do.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah. I can't think Stravinsky making wrong notes on a score. That's...
Well,
a lot of notes.
Yeah, there are a lot of notes, and there are a lot, you know, a lot of transpositions, some foreign instruments in there. You don't every day write for a Wagner tuba, or just the, you know, it's not like a Beethoven chord, a cadenza at the end of a symphony that you line up and you say, oh, well, of course, my orchestration that I studied when I was 20 years old, that looks. You can't look at the Stravinsky score and say, well, some people might be able to, but look and say, oh, there's a mistake, you know. Because the chords just are crunched together in, like I said, a beautiful way.
Well, I was thinking, talking about that first performance in 1913, and the piece is very raw, but it was probably even more raw that first time hearing that. And I'm wondering if you're feeling, and you're hearing your piece of music performed with orchestra, for the first time, what kind of an experience is that? Is it a little nerve-wracking?
Yeah, we were just talking about a little bit of this. So there's a famous recording in the late 20s, I think, of Stravinsky conducting, what orchestra, Columbia or something?
I think so.
And it's not wonderful. It's it's the piece is still fine. It's 15 years old at this point, but still finding its way. And it still sounds very raw, very new. And, you know, I think every new piece is going to sound like that until it sort of finds its pocket. It finds, you know, exactly what the right kind of tempos are. Mm-hmm. And the musicians get comfortable with, you know, rhythmic interplay and things like that. So I think there's a time when, it, you know, there was a time where no one really was tackling the Rite of Spring. And now, like I was telling Ryan, the high school all-state orchestra in Texas did it last year. So, you know, I think it took, you know, 100+ years for that to happen. But, you know, we as composers, we all hope at some point our music will be as ubiquitous as something like
that. But, you know, I completely agree. The thing about the recording industry, and maybe this is sacrilege to say at a radio station with the whole library of recordings that rely on recordings, but there is something to be said about recordings, and that is, as Clint says, this is a rough recording. However, it is unbelievable and incredible because, yes, maybe the orchestra can't do it. I mean, the truth is Stravinsky couldn't conduct it. So that was probably the majority of the issues is that he just couldn't conduct what he wrote because it is so complex. But there's a really special aspect to it because of that raw, edgy, new discovery moment that you feel like you're witnessing firsthand. And that's what I love also about some other recordings. I won't go specific to those orchestras, but there are orchestras back in the day who always had sort of their own identifying features. When you listen to them, you could say, oh, this is Vienna, or that's Marinsky, or this is London, or that's Berlin. And today, it's becoming more and more sort of mixed and combined to where it's more difficult because we have people who, we have Americans in the Vienna Philharmonic, or we have, you know, French in the Berlin Philharmonic or something like that. And so the sounds are starting to sort of maybe agree a bit more. But some of those old Marinsky recordings that seem really gruff and rough around the edge, even when they go around now touring, it's amazing. And it's not polished like, you know, you might hear another orchestra play, but it's that grit and that dust which makes some of these works just come to life, and you almost desire that sort of edge to those performances. So it's really intriguing, yeah, it's exciting.
Well, I'm thinking there's sort of multiple legacies going on here. you know, your association with Clint, but also the inspiration of the Rite of Spring for Clint, and a piece of music that is continuing to influence composers and musicians today, but also the connection with Pierre Monteur, and that must be very special for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I remember my teacher talking about, you know, his lessons and what he experienced with him. And it's funny you say legacy, because actually that was the first piece of Clint's that I conducted, a piece called Legacy, when we were at undergrad, remember?
Yeah, I did.
A long time ago. It probably sounded like the Stravinsky recording, wow, maybe at that time. But but anyway, it was, yeah, it's really, these types of works in the repertoire are unique to perform. Musicians, you know, bend over backwards to be a part of these performances, especially with the Rite.
Absolutely.
And also, you know, it's a thrill to be able to continue to commission composers and be a very important part in the development of music today, specifically American music, which, quite honestly, we don't do enough of in America. It's sort of wild and crazy, but it is our charge, the symphony here in Sioux City, to be a part of that and to propel that forward, so that we are discovering the next Sarajevo, we are discovering the next Stravinsky. It's our responsibility, and if we're not doing it, it won't happen. So when you have amazing composers who are teaching the next generation, when you have orchestras who are responsible for developing those young people into what the next voice of music is, those are perfect collaborations, perfect relationships. And that's what true art is all about, at the development stage of what's to come next.
Well, Clint, we will look forward to hearing your composition and the premiere of that Saturday night and the Rite of Spring. And is there going to be a pre-concert talk, Ryan?
Yeah, Clint and I actually will be speaking at 6:45 at the Orpheum. So stop on by. And if not, the concert starts at 7:30.
Tickets at the door, but you can contact the Sioux City Symphony office. Trinette can get you fixed up.
Absolutely. At 712-277-2111.
All right. Well, composer Clint Needham, have enjoyed talking with you this morning.
Yeah, it's been great.
We'll look forward to hearing your piece tomorrow evening.
I do too.
And Ryan, as always, our music director and conductor, the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra, who every time I interface, I learn so much from you. Thank you for sharing your time today.
Always a pleasure, Gretchen. Thank you.
And you're listening to Siouxland Public Media, your local public radio station. And that will be on tomorrow night's program with the Sioux City Symphony Orchestra. That was L'Île de Songe. That will be music of Kaya Sarriaho. That will be one of the compositions on the docket for tomorrow night. We will head back to Studio A. We've got more music that will be performed, more live music being performed this Sunday at the Sioux City Chamber Music Association. The Sonic String Quartet will be in town. There's a bit of a hometown boy coming back and performing, and Gretchen Gondek joins him in Studio A.
Thank you, Steve. And I guess we're going to call this part two of our live broadcast today. Earlier, of course, speaking with Ryan Haskins from the Sioux City Symphony and composer Clint Needham about their program on Saturday evening, 7:30 at the Orpheum Theater. It's quite a musical weekend because Sioux City Chamber Music will be performing at First Presbyterian Church 3 o'clock on Sunday. And part of the Sonic Quartet is in studio here, Seth May Patterson. Hello.
Hello.
And welcome.
Thank you.
You have a very solid background and upbringing, kind of a nice mixture of music and theater, as we were talking before we went on the air. And of course, Eleanor May Patterson, still continuing to teach and spread classical music around in the community and playing in the orchestra, and I mean, an amazing resume. And of course, an influence for you as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I grew up in Sioux City. I went through the public school system. I went to Longfellow and the old East Middle School, and then also I graduated from East High School in 2005. And then I started going to college and bouncing around. So
you have training in all of the kind of standard classical music, and I think it's interesting. The Sonic String Quartet does classics, but I saw Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. I saw all kinds of things that really intrigued me, and you've toured with Judy Collins and Michael Bublé, the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. So you have quite a reach in your performing.
Yeah, I've been really lucky to be in Seattle. I've been in Seattle since the fall of 2008, and so ever since then I've been freelancing. I originally moved out to study with a teacher, so I had a really great opportunity there. As far as touring, I just got really, really lucky, with making connections and meeting certain people. Rebecca Chung Felice is our cellist, and she was one of the first people that I met, in 2009. And so I've been a member of the Sonic String Quartet, for about those 10 years.
So this is a quartet that you created.
Well, Rebecca created it. She's
the manager,
yeah.
Okay.
And she was actually looking for a new violist. And funnily enough, I found her on Craigslist, of all places, because I had just moved out there and I had no job. I had no income at all. And so I was looking for anything. And so I went to Craigslist and saw that she was looking for a violist. And I went in and played for her. And we hit it off, and we've been playing together ever since.
Yeah. And you do a fair amount of traveling. This is a full-time profession for you?
I do. Well, I do a lot of, I live in Seattle. I do a lot of teaching, private teaching, and also coaching, as well as freelancing. The traveling is mainly just specific tours, and they're normally pretty short. Yeah.
And I looked on your Facebook page and your website, and saw some very beautiful pictures of weddings and mm-hmm. other events that you do. So talk a little bit about that experience.
Well, Sonic String Quartet has originally, playing weddings is a really easy way to get a good amount of income. And, the rep is pretty, it actually started pretty standard. But then Sonic String Quartet's interesting because we have a wide variety of repertoire, and we can play classically. But we also have our own library of arrangements. Some of the pieces that we'll be playing, we do actually play at the weddings, but we play pieces by Jimi Hendrix. We're going to play a piece by Queen, one of my own arrangements. Also, Muse is another one. Beatles, Nirvana, a lot of really just kind of Yeah, favorite.
That's wonderful. So you do the transcriptions?
On some of the pieces, yeah. Mm-hmm. I've started doing more arranging just recently.
And I love Game of Thrones. Now, that has to be a really fun piece to play.
It's a lot of fun. That's actually another one of my arrangements, too. And that was a lot of fun to arrange. And it's definitely fun, yeah.
Did you follow the HBO?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I watched it all.
Yeah, it was sad when it ended. I felt like I just finished a really good book, and I didn't want to put it down.
Yeah.
What other kinds of opportunities are you finding through the Sonic Quartet and through, you know, doing transcriptions and doing all these kind of modern arrangements? And what other opportunities are there for musicians and composers out there that you're seeing?
Well, you just get an opportunity to work with a whole bunch of different kinds of musicians, and they're producing different kinds of music. I just did a transcription. It was this kind of very ornamented, kind of Indian style. It was just the violin line. I actually did it for Rachel, who's our second violinist in our quartet. And it was a nice challenge for me because it's something that it was very complicated and very intricate, and it took me a while, but definitely a good exercise in doing that. So you just get exposed to different kinds of music. I've played with a lot of different kinds of musicians. I've played with Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. So he's a rapper out of Seattle. Uh-huh. I've played with Judy Collins, of course, and so she's like legendary folk singer. But then, of course, you have classical stuff, and it's just really cool to kind of have a wide span of covering everything. Some people have a certain focus, some people do, you know, their specific thing, but it's also really good as far as being a musician today to be able to be flexible and be adaptable to different styles and different sounds and being open. Yeah.
Well, I suppose you have to be flexible and you have to diversify yourself. That's why I think this is so brilliant. You know, being strictly a classical performer, I think, probably limits you.
Well, it's super hard too. I mean, the field is immensely
crowded
and competitive too.
Yeah.
It's super crowded. There's a million people that are fantastic at playing violin, playing viola, cello, whatever, and they're actively auditioning, and oftentimes there's one audition that's open and hundreds of people come in. I just did an audition for the Cincinnati Symphony. And there was 3 days of auditions, and there was 400 violists, and it was because there was 3 slots. You know, I don't even know if they hired all 3 slots. You know, so lots of people fly in from all over the world for these positions. So if you want to go the classical route, it's amazing. And if you win a job, it's amazing. It is the dream. But it's really, really hard and competitive. So yeah, I mean, this is kind of just one little outlet to still play music, to do something a little bit different. Not everything has to be classical. And also playing rock music is super fun. I played with the Sioux City Rockestra way in the very beginning.
Sure.
And so it's really fun to come back and see that they just recorded an album. And so that's really amazing. But also I kind of took some of that experience to Seattle as well. I play in a group called the Seattle Rock Orchestra. And it's similar to Rockestra in that it's kind of a big cover band. I've played lots of like Led Zeppelin solos on my viola, so I'm amplified. I have a pickup, I have a distortion pedal, and Rachel as well. I mean, she's killer at just shredding some like Pink Floyd solos. We've had a whole lot of fun. I've also played in Seattle Rock Orchestra for about the 10 years that I've been in Seattle as well. It's one of the groups I initially got involved in.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Sioux City Chamber Music Association. Your concert is this Sunday at 3:00 at First Presbyterian Church. You can get a ticket at the door. Mm-hmm. I would imagine because of your Sioux City connections, this program sort of transpired, and now you've come back to perform. And what... what's on the program? I know you mentioned a few things, but could you go through that again?
Well, let's see. I'll try and pull up some of the set list. Yeah, we actually don't have a program, so we're going to be announcing everything at the concert. So it'll be a really unique live. Let's see. Just pulling it up really quick. I wrote down we're doing some Jimi Hendrix, Queen, Muse, The Beatles, Nirvana, and we'll also do Sorry, pulling up on my phone. Super exciting. we're going to play a little bit of Macklemore as well. We'll do some thrift shop. We'll have a couple movie favorites. So we'll be doing Let It Go from Frozen, Pure Imagination from Willy Wonka. So some classic, really nice stuff. Kashmir, Led Zeppelin. Got some Ed Sheeran. We'll be doing Galway Girl and Shape of You. I did an arrangement of the Postal Service. They did a song called Such Great Heights, and then that was redone by Iron and Wine. And so it's a totally different take on the original song. And so I did a string quartet version of Iron and Wine's version of that song. So it's Such Great Heights. Another one of my favorite arrangements is Aerials by System of a Down. They're an Armenian metal band that I listened to when I was growing up. And I was just really influenced by their harmonies. And so I wrote a string quartet arrangement of that one as well.
And you're interested in film. What does it take to be a film composer today and put scores together?
That's not something that I do. I do have friends in Seattle that do that. And it is very involved. It's a whole lot of work. I've been a part of recording projects where one of my friends, his name is Andrew Jocelyn. He is a film composer and he's actively writing scores. A lot of times on very tight turnaround times, but he somehow is able to compose everything, mix everything, write out all the parts. And I've been a part of recording those scores as well.
So you've done, not the composition, but you've done transcriptions from Frozen. And what was the other film you mentioned?
Well, those two arrangements are not my own, but I've done transcriptions and then I've done arrangements. And so transcriptions are a little bit different in that I'm actually just writing the part of what it is. I'm not putting any extra thought behind it. The arrangements are, you know, I kind of take the original and I try and distribute it, you know, because you listen to a band and you have a guitar, you have a voice, you have bass, you have all the different things. And so I have to decide, oh, do I put that in the cello line? Do I put it in the viola line, violin? How do I mix it up? And then, of course, you can take a little more liberty and, you know, add variations on the rhythm and harmonies and stuff. So I mainly do the arranging. I've just recently kind of gotten into transcriptions, which is similar to arranging, but it's different a little bit.
How much time do you dedicate to classical music in your performances? Or does that sort of vary because if it's a wedding?
Weddings are a little, they're different just because we're very familiar with the repertoire. It's not necessarily the most challenging repertoire, but you still have to have it at a level where, you know, you're playing at a wedding. You can't really mess up because then you're at a wedding and it all goes wrong. Classical music really has a large portion of my life and my time, especially in Seattle. Whether it's coaching or whether it's driving to rehearsal or arranging, I mean, pretty much all my time in Seattle is spent in some musical way. Yeah.
So you were talking about, you don't really call it a program, but do you plan? Or is it more of a kind of spontaneous process when you're, for example, what you're doing on Sunday? You sit down with the quartet and talk about, this is what I think we should do.
So we've kind of talked about, I mean, we have a really large catalog. If you go to our website, Sonic String Quartet, you'll see all of the stuff that we can play for weddings and also for live performances. But so we had to kind of cater and limit our time. And so we chose this set list, and so we've been preparing, you know, this batch of songs.
Okay.
We still are going to kind of, the rest of the quartet arrives this evening, and so tomorrow we're going to be deciding on a final order. And then so that's why it's kind of, it's a little bit of a work in progress, but we also know, you know, which songs we're going to do.
So where can people find out more information? And you can actually listen to your music on, is it SoundCloud?
Yeah, so Sonic, let me pull up the website for it. Sonic String Quartet, I think it's .org. I could be wrong. So I know we have a lot of sound files on our website that you can access as well. And also this concert on Sunday will be recorded, and so I'm really hoping to add these files as well to the website. And so if you aren't able to make it out, we will be adding these files to the website as well, so you'll get a chance to hear.
Okay, and how's it been in Sioux City? Have you been surprised by all the construction and progress and...
Yeah, there's more construction than I remember. Also, I just pulled up the website sonicstringquartet.com.
Okay.
Yeah, not .org.com. Being in Sioux City is always great. I've been away for a while, and so I really cherish the time that I have here. Normally, I'm able to come back for about a couple weeks. This time, it was only 1 week, so it does feel a little bit shorter. So my time is super crammed, but I'm trying to spend my time and see as many people as I possibly can. I really like coming back to Sioux City and seeing everything. It's always very comfortable, and it's definitely a different vibe than being in the busyness of Seattle, for sure.
Well, I think it's just a real treat for all of us who know your folks to have you come back and perform with the quartet. I think that's a real treat and a great opportunity to hear some fantastic music.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, we want to mention Sioux City Chamber Music offering a concert featuring the Sonic String Quartet here in Sioux City, 3 o'clock on Sunday.
I also wanted to say, I forgot to mention, our cellist, Rebecca, as I was mentioning, she actually had an injury last week, and so she's not able to be here. So I'm very happy to say that we were recommended Corinne Bolt, who's the associate principal cellist with Sioux City Symphony. So as it turns out, we're doing a small collaboration with a member of Sioux City Symphony on Sunday. And she's been really great to work with. We just had a rehearsal yesterday, and she read through everything just fine, and I think it's going to be a great performance. But
that's wonderful. Yeah. Oh, those things happen to musicians. Yeah.
It was magic. It really was. Yeah.
All right. Well, we've been in dialogue with Seth May Patterson, member of the Sonic String Quartet, and congratulations. Thanks for coming back to Sioux City, and thank you for making time to have some conversation today about Sioux City Chamber Music Association.